This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
Well, good Thursday morning, everybody. I am Glenda Geek from Ocala, Florida.
And I am Alice Jovich from Arlington, Texas. And you are listening to a special trail riding episode of Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for July 17th, episode 938. This episode is brought to you by the North American Trail Ride Conference and Cold River Equine Sports Medicine and Rehabilitation. Good morning, Horse World.
Thursday. I'm so happy it's Thursday.
Just an ordinary day.
If you love to ride horses, but you'd rather ride on a trail than in an arena, I think I know a sport just for you.
We're out. We're getting to the first mark. We're a little ahead of time.
Expect nothing less than full-blown chaos.
Well, welcome, everybody. Thank you for listening to Horses in the Morning. We appreciate you being here this morning. Of course, this is the third Thursday of the month, which means it's time for Alice to come back, and she is from the North American Trail Ride Conference, and we talk trail riding, which is probably about what 85% of our audience does, so we're always happy to have you every month. Good morning, Alice.
Good morning, Glenn. How are you doing today?
Terrific. Thank you so much for joining us. I know all across, especially the southern part of the country, that trail riding has been upended over the last week or two by the rain. Every time we try and go out and do something with our ponies here in Florida, it's just been raining nonstop.
It started raining here last night, and one of the counties north of us got 9 inches of rain overnight.
Whoa!
So I think we're at 2 to 3 inches here in Arlington. It's wet, but it's not sodden.
Well, it knocks the dust down.
That's
it,
right.
Keeps the dust down.
Yeah, we don't have to worry about horses having enough water in the trough.
No, I'll tell you what, it's been the same here. And in Florida, we can get, 5 inches of rain in 2 hours, and then an hour later, it doesn't look like we've had any. So
yeah.
It just goes away so quick with all of the sand, but it certainly has been a wet one this year, and I know that it has been for a lot of the South. We
were happy to see it because it was really, really hot last week.
Yeah, and you guys, have you been dry, or have you been getting enough rain there in Arlington?
They tell us that we're still in a drought, but we've had a lot more rain this year than we did last year. So I don't.
Yeah, you guys were past couple years have been bad, drought-wise.
Yeah, I don't think we're out of the drought technically, but they're saying that an El Nino is forming out in the Pacific, and that always means more rain for us.
So that's a good thing in this case, and I know California needs it for sure. So let's hope that is the case. Well, that's terrific, and I know we have a good show planned for today, and Jennifer's going to tell us about that.
On today's special trail riding episode, brought to you, as Alice said, Cold River Equine Sports Medicine and Rehabilitation. Try saying that first thing in the morning before coffee. Golly! After a quick chat about ride pacing and a cutting-edge review of cutting devices, we will be catching up with Dr. Stephanie Ostrowski for a perfectly timed discussion about avoiding heat stress for horse and rider. And then rounding out our Thursday adventure, Melissa Neal from Cold River Equine offers up some great ways to keep your horse fit in the summer heat. So stay tuned for the fray, folks.
Thank you, Jennifer. And I have a daily whinny today. My daily whinny goes out to a couple of our terrific listeners who have birthdays today. Happy birthday to Kelly Renner. And also Lorraine Milosevic, happy birthday to both of you, and you get this.
Happy birthday, happy.
So happy birthday to them. Well, you have you been out and around and trail riding? What have you been doing over the last month?
Well, in June, I just went on a couple of pleasure rides. We went to Trace Trails, the place where I manage a ride back where I managed to ride back in May. And then we went to another place here in Texas called Tarrant Ranch, which is south of Tyler, Texas. They have beautiful, like, lake. I mean, not a true lake, but, you know, like a man-made lake and really great trails. So we could ride and swim and just camp out. And that was a lot of fun. It's been kind of hot, and I've been working a lot. So I figure I'll work now, and then I can play more when the weather's nicer. But this weekend, my daughter and myself and a couple other folks are going to Bar 50 Ranch in Bismarck, Arkansas, and we're going to trail ride this weekend. It's near Hot Springs, so you may have to go to Hot Springs and sit in the spa or something, too.
Now, do you try and go to new places all the time, or do you have old favorites that you end up going back to?
Well, Bar 50 is an old favorite. We used to go quite a bit, and then summers, we just hadn't had time, or, you know, gas got more expensive, so we weren't going as much. But for a while, my daughter and I went every year. But I like to find new places. I heard about a new place in Oklahoma, and the name escapes me right now, but some friends went there, and they really liked it, and I'm always up for someplace new.
Now, when you go camping like that, do you how many hours do you ride a day? Do you try and get, like, a couple hours in every day, or do you go out twice? I know a lot of people go out in the morning and then go out in the evening. What do you do usually?
Well, when we went a couple weeks ago, we rode mostly in the morning. But honestly, when we're riding for fun, we're not very early risers. We tend to get up and drink our coffee and eat our breakfast. And we always say that we're going to be on the trail by 7. It's usually more like 9. And we'll ride to lunch, and then we'll come in and eat. And then some of the group will go back out, and some of the group is like, nah, they're done, and they'll go swim. And then some of the group will go back out and ride again in the evening. It just depends on what each person wants to do. So I usually want to ride more than the others. They always tease me about being an addict.
Well, so, you know, but, and I guess you can kind of overdo it when you're out and about, too, because you think, wow, I'm here. I came out to ride, so let's ride 12 hours today.
Right. Well, I know that we'll probably ride 4 to 6 hours at least up at Bar 50 because the trails don't loop back. Like where we've been the last couple of times, the trails loop and take a break and then go back out. But these trails, there's one way in and out of the camp. And so then you just go out and ride. And once you come back in, it's harder to talk yourself into going back out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. And, you know, and then on Monday, do you regret all that riding that you did over the weekend?
Oh, no, because I'm not coming home until Monday.
Okay.
I won't regret it until Tuesday.
Your body goes, oh, I shouldn't have gone that extra hour.
No, I mean, well, I don't know. I might be sore because I haven't been riding so much, but I'm usually not terribly sore anymore, maybe a little stiff or tired just from not sleeping in my own bed, but typically I'm not overly sore. And this time I'm going with a friend who has a really nice living quarters trailer, so I don't have to pitch my tent and I don't have to sleep outside. So
yeah, there's definitely an advantage to that, isn't there?
Yeah, there is.
I don't care what campers say, sleeping in a tent still is not the best situation.
Think about it. The living quarters is just a tent with tires under it.
Oh, and air conditioning and beds.
Well,
and sometimes a bathroom.
Well, we actually have bathrooms at this campground. Bar 50 has a really awesome campground, and it's got a bajillion hookups. And then they also have, if you don't want to camp, they have cowboy rooms that have 2 beds in them. And you can stay there, or they have a bunkhouse, or they have a cabin. And they actually have 2 cabins. And then they have rooms in the lodge, and they serve breakfast. So if you want to get up and have breakfast and go out later, you can have their breakfast buffet. It's a really fun place.
I always hated, though, you know, when tent camping, and my family was campers, me not so much anymore, but, you know, getting up to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night and walking the block to get to the bathroom and back, by then I'm awake. Like, okay,
right.
Well, you know, now I'm done.
Right.
That's the reason I said bathroom in the living quarters trailer.
Well, yeah, we have like 6 people that are sleeping in this trailer, and we already know that we can only use the living quarters bathroom at night. People tried to use that bathroom.
Yeah.
All
rules.
Weekend long.
You need rules.
Yeah, that's right.
Not be good.
Guidelines. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, now, you have a riding tip for us, brought to you by the NATRC.
I do. People, whenever you compete at an NATRC ride, they are it's a timed event. You know, it's not a race like an endurance ride, and it's not just an obstacle challenge like a trail challenge would be. It's kind of in between. So they give us a minimum time and a maximum time for each division. So novice and competitive pleasure have one speed and distance to go, and open has another speed and distance to go. And they put points on the trail, and the trail master will tell us what time you should be at each point on ride time. So as we start the ride, we put our watches on midnight, or if you have a digital watch, you set the timer to zero. I personally like a face watch that I can just put to midnight because I've had too much trouble with accidentally bumping my timer and then being completely off time. So whenever I go on the trail, if I have to be, if A is 4 miles away and my pace is 4 miles an hour, I should be at A when my watch says 1 hour. And then there's different variations, you know, for the time, depending on how fast or slow you're going. I mean, like 5 miles an hour, 5 miles would be you'd be at 1 hour. So you keep up with your time throughout the ride. And on the map, they tell you A, 4 miles, 1 hour, B, 8 miles, 2 hours. And, of course, it's not quite that exact, but, you know, they figure it out exactly. So that when you get to each point on the trail, you can check your watch and you can say, oh, look, if I'm at A and it's only 45 minutes, I'm a little fast. Or you can get to A and your watch may say it's an hour and 10 minutes, I'm going a little too slow. And then you can adjust your pace. Otherwise,
okay,
you get to the end of the sorry.
Okay.
Go ahead.
This is the question from the math challenged person in this group.
Okay.
So the ride organizer gives you essentially a cheat sheet in that it tells you as you go from A, B, C, D, E, the distance between each of those letters or each of those stops and the approximate time and the amount of time it should take you. But the judging in that, whether or not you get penalty points or not, is for the whole ride. So if you're a little too fast on the first section and then you slow down a little bit on the second section and then the third section you get exactly right, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, as far as whether or not you get penalized for going too fast or too slow, that only counts at the very end. It's not a case of, oh, the first section you were a little too slow, you get 2 points.
Right. That's true.
Okay.
For the most part. There is extenuating circumstance. If the person is going really fast, like one time at one of the rides I managed, we had an open rider. The ride was paced at 5 miles an hour. And this one open rider was riding at 6 miles an hour. And she actually got to the second pulse and respiration stop before we were finished and ready to move on. And so
wow.
we ended up making her wait, but which is allowed if they're outside the time. But, you know, like you could miss an obstacle. If you're too fast or too slow, you could miss an obstacle or a PNR. And that would cause you to lose points. But in general, at the end of the ride, if you come in, there's a window. So if the time at A is 1 hour, and that is the middle time or the mid time, you could get to A as early as 45 minutes or an hour and 15 minutes and still be in your window.
Got it.
They always give you a window. And so when we're doing a ride meeting, we always kind of warn people, please try to stay in your window. At the ride I managed, we had one person who was her first rides, and her horse was a little out of shape, and she got really far behind. And she ended up making most of it up, but I think she missed an obstacle because the judges had to move on.
Right. So at the end of the ride, you get to the finish line, and the total ride time was a maximum of, you could go as slow as 6 hours or as fast as 5 hours and 15 minutes. As long as you are between those two, you get a score of zero because it's a penalty point-based system, right?
Right. Well, right. You would only be penalized on time if you were outside your half-hour window. So
okay.
If,
so if you went
super-duper
fast and got done in 5 hours, how is the point system assessed? Is it a certain number of points per minute? How does that work?
Yes. It's one per minute that you are early.
Okay.
So if the mid time is 6 hours, your window would be 5:45 to 6:15. So if you came in at 5:30, you would lose 15 points.
Got
it. If you came in at 6:30, you would lose 15 points.
Okay.
And
so
the
rate at which you were penalized is the same, too fast or too slow, it doesn't matter.
Right.
As I said, this is the math-challenged person here. Is it very common for, let's say, for example, more experienced riders and horses who have been doing this for a while and the initial fitness is not an issue and the how it all works is not an issue? I know in endurance racing, those horses are really fit. The first part of the race, they go a little bit faster just because they need to blow off that excess steam. Is it common for this type of riding for the horses to go a little quicker at the beginning of the race and a little slower, or is the whole goal to make it pretty even throughout?
Well, it depends on the weather and the terrain, and a lot of times your horse's fitness or breed. Like folks who have heavier muscled horses or quarter horses or like a friend that rides a draft horse, they'll go a little harder and faster early in the day when it's cooler. They still try to stay within their window, but they'll ride on the minimum time. So, you know, they'll be buttoned up against that minimum time so that later in the day when it's hot, that actually gives them like an extra 30 minutes that they can piddle later if they need to.
Got it. Oh, there's a lot of strategy involved with this.
There is. And then the other thing that happens is we have what they call the two-mile marker. And at the two-mile marker, once you pass that point, you have to maintain forward motion. You don't have to run or trot. You can just walk. But if you pass the two-mile marker, you can't turn back. And so you want to make sure at that point especially that you're ready to go on into camp, because if your horse has a really fast walk and you're a little early, you could get there too soon. Or if your horse has, you know, it's easier to make up time in the two-mile than it is to slow down in the two-mile. At least my experience has been, because I can always hustle that last 2 miles, you know, because then I know
right.
the gun.
So the two mile marker happens just before each station.
No, it's at the very end of the ride. The 2 miles.
Oh, at the very end. Okay, so there's only one 2 mile marker. Got it. So it works a little bit like that. I don't know if they still do in the combined training or eventing business. There used to be a rule that once you got within a certain distance, it might have been in the Pony Club. That once you got within a certain distance of the finish line, you weren't allowed to stop and walk because people would go around the course way too fast and stop and walk the last, like, 100 yards so they wouldn't get penalized. But in the case of the trail rides, you have to maintain forward motion. You can't just stop and graze your horse for 15 minutes because you went too fast.
Right, and you can't do that here either. And sometimes the judge will hide inside the 2 mile just to watch people if they're crowding it, because they can't stop you to do anything. But they can watch how you're riding. They can see if you're crowding another rider, like if you're too close. That's a safety issue. They can see if you're actually maintaining forward motion inside the 2 mile, you know, if you did stop to graze. Now, like, the exception to the 2 mile, like if you go across water in the last 2 miles and your horse stops and drinks, like you can't stop your horse to drink, but if the horse like sticks its head down and starts to drink, that's okay. You know, or like if you're going by water, I've had my horse not want to drink all day long, and then inside the 2 mile, there'll be a puddle next to the road, and all of a sudden they have to have that puddle. And that's all right. You don't have to pull their head up from the water.
That's a horse for you. There you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
We used to do the same. We used to do a similar thing with in the car years ago. We used to do orienteering with the car. It used to be a competition with optimum time, just like that. But they only would give you, this before the days of GPS, they would only give you a picture of the a diagram of what the turn looked like that you were supposed to turn at, no road names or anything. So,
oh, wow.
You, and you would have to watch your speeds, and there would be a certain speed between each one, and you'd have to watch your speedometer, and they would cover up part of your dashboard so you couldn't cheat. And it was a lot of fun, and people would bring their antique cars out to do it a lot of times. And there is still, I think they still do car orienteering. And I know there's horse orienteering. We've talked about that too. It sounds similar to that, only your trails are marked, right?
Right, our trails are marked. But we've done a little orienteering down here just for fun, and it's never really caught on in spite of...
That's because people kept getting lost in the woods and not coming back for a week.
That could be.
That's why.
But we like it. I mean, we've done some on Sundays after our trail challenges. We'll do some... We have a girl that really likes to set up orienteering courses, and we've done that just for the heck of it. And it's a lot of fun.
Well, I know, Jennifer, you've done them in the past, the orienteering ones where they've actually written clues that are like in riddles and things like that. So
yes.
Which tree you turn at is, you know, kind of
yes.
done in a riddle, and you have to figure it out. And those are a lot of fun just because they're fun. You know, it adds a little element
right.
to it.
Right. And these ones are really designed to be used, to be ridden where there are trails of some sort, in that in proper orienteering, you have to use a compass to get where you're going. And the
right.
ones we used to ride in, and I, for the life of me, I can't remember the name of what they call them at this moment. One of our listeners will put it on Facebook, I'm sure. But you would head out, and you'd kind of have to be very observant. Oh, look, there's a clue over there on that tree with a handkerchief tied to it. And as you went around, you'd have to collect something from that spot to prove that you got there, and the fastest team would win. And they're great fun. And that would be a fun and interesting thing. It's very related to the competitive trail rides without the need for an obstacle. But it was very much judged on the fact that you had to show up where to the right spot. And you had to – a lot of times you have to answer a quiz question to get your little marker and stuff. So, yeah. And I got lost a lot on those too, because I try to go too fast, and then I get lost.
we put letters on the trees, and then after we'd have to, like, fill in each spot with the letters. And at the end, it would say something.
That's okay, yeah. That makes sense. There's so much fun stuff you can do, right, if you only have the time and the inclination to get it done. There's just so much that you can do to make it interesting and fun.
Yeah.
Well, now, when you go out on these rides in the middle of the woods, I know there's one thing that you never go out without, and that is our product review of the month.
I, both from doing the NATRC ride and the Texas Trail Challenge rides, have learned to always have a knife on me. And I actually have lots of different knives. I've bought some off the internet on Woot, and I have, Woot has some really great knives one time, and I've been given a lot of knives. But the best knife that I have is called the Mora knife. It's Mora of Sweden. Knives. They sell them on Amazon, and they're all different price ranges, but the one I have is only about $15.50. They're made from a special steel. It doesn't rust easily, and it also is hard, so it stays sharp. And the sheets come in lots of different fun colors. So my knife is orange, and so I put it on my boot with some strings. And people are always like, what's on your boot? And I'm like, oh, that's my knife. Does it look like I have a carrot coming out of my boot? My daughter has one that's lime green.
I'm looking at them here on Amazon, and they are all different colors. And it's M-O-R-A of Sweden is the name, M-O-R-A of Sweden. And for $15, to have a good knife for $15 is not bad at all.
No. It's really sharp. I mean, I've used it to, cut a lead rope, or you can cut vine. I've used it to cut my steak at dinner. I've used it, for all kinds of things. But it's always good to have a knife with you, because you never know if your horse is going to get tangled in something, or if they, if somebody needs help, or when the horse is at the trailer. And in the NATRC and the Texas Trail Challenge competition, if we have our knife on our body, when a judge asks for it, we get extra points. So that's always helpful. Or we'll get a plus for having it on our body.
So they really do want you to have it.
Yes. So the juniors don't have to have knives. They, they don't necessarily want to turn an 8-year-old loose with a really sharp knife. But but all the adults have to have one.
Why? Why wouldn't you want to do that?
Well, I don't know. My daughter always had her own knife. Thinking, safe-wise. So.
These are great. They're $15, and you can find Jennifer. I'll put a link to them on our Facebook page and our show notes at Horses in the Morning as well. You know, this is something, you know, you don't think about, you know, as far as getting a good one. Now, this was not foldable. This is not a folding knife. This actually has a sheath to it.
And it clicks down in, and if you, it only goes in the sheath one way. If you put it in the sheath correctly, it stays in really nice and solid. It's never crumbly.
Well, that was my question, because I know a lot of the sheaths tend to be loose, and then the things are bouncing around in there.
No, if you put it in backwards, it doesn't go in quite right, but you can tell that it's not in there properly. But I like it because this one, like I have some ties that fit on it. It's got a hole in the bottom of the sheath, and so I have the little stretchy ties that go through the bottom, and then I also have one that goes around the top, and when I'm wearing my cowboy boots, I'll actually flip it over the top of my boot and then secure it with the stretchy band.
And this one also looks like it has a belt loop on it, too, is the way it looks.
Yeah, that's what I hook under my boot.
Very good. Well, that's a good product. We've never talked about one of those before. I've never heard of Mora, so they appear to have a whole bunch of different kinds of knives as well.
Well, I am told that the Scandinavian people make the best knives. I have friends that swear by those knives over other knives.
Yeah, and I was always told the same thing, actually, about kitchen knives, is you want to get something that's from Germany or somewhere over there. They tend to have the best knives. And I can tell you, I did that. I actually spent the money. Jennifer's dad used to be a butcher, and I actually spent the money and got the kitchen knives that were $80 each, you know, the set of them that were $80 each, from the proper kitchen, restaurant kitchen store. And I'm still using them a good 20 years later. They definitely were good knives. And so knives are worth getting the better ones.
Yes. Do you ever need a knife when you're driving? I mean, is that important to have any kind of that equipment when you're out?
You know, you're supposed to carry one. You're
you
supposed
can.
To because if your cart turns over, yeah. Now, there's two things there. If your cart turns over, then you may have to cut the harness to get the horse out. Now, that usually is more of a concern when you have a big carriage as opposed to a smaller cart, but it still could happen with a cart. Now, my harness is a quick-release harness, which means that I can pull a couple straps, you can pretty much get it disconnected, but still, I mean, the trace could be caught in there. So, yes, technically I should carry a knife when I'm driving. Do I? No, but I should.
Yes. And you have to have a seriously heavy-duty knife because the type of harness you use if you had just a wimpy little, you know, multi-tool knife that you picked up for $13.99, it's not going to cut
it
your harness.
Work.
So,
no.
Yeah, you really need it. And Glenn has one. He just doesn't carry it with him.
It's just one of those things, you know, you think about by the time I put on my helmet and do all that stuff and get all the stuff. I want to get out driving sometime today. So,
yeah, we're going to duct tape it to your helmet. That's how about that? We'll duct tape it to the back of your helmet, and you'll be good to go.
There you go. That'd be good. Well, now, we also have a sponsor today, and that we're going to talk a little bit about the Saltus Training Center.
Yes. Wendy Gardner. They're located in North Texas, in Aubrey, Texas. It is conveniently located an hour north of the DFW airport. She is a training, and Wendy does training and marketing for Arabian horses especially, but welcomes all breeds. She's located in a weather-friendly facility, and the horses are fed three times a day. Stalls are cleaned twice daily, and there's unlimited access to large and well-maintained indoor arena, a round pen and a hot walker. Also, there's a huge outdoor arena, trails on site, and then there's mini trails just about 5 miles away from her. Whether you need help tuning up a show horse, working with a problem horse, starting a youngster to ride, or finding your dream horse, or selling one that isn't quite working out for you, Wendy is always thrilled to help you with all of these needs. She is a NATRAC competitor, an NATRC competitor, and I've met her at some rides. She actually rides a horse that used to belong to another friend of mine, and they're doing great together. It's a half Arab, half saddlebred horse. She does endurance riding as well, and she's just an all-around great gal. She a really busy spring training and moving a lot of horses through, and she's got a lot of space in her barn right now and would really like to have some more horses to train.
And it's not, it doesn't have to be just Arabs. It can be Arabs, quarter horses, whatever. Yeah.
No, she goes to a lot of shows, and, you know, she takes the horses out and gets them to shows, and, you know, she doesn't just leave them at the, doesn't just work with them there at her facility. She takes them everywhere. You know, she goes to NATRC rides or endurance rides, or, you know, she takes some trail riding close by. And, I mean, she works with all breeds. It's just Arabs are her favorite.
Right, right. Well, and I see here that, you know, she does do a little bit of, I'm looking at the pictures of some of the pretty horses on her website. Because Arabs take the best pictures.
They do.
Arab horses just take the best pictures. They always look so stunning in pictures. They are photogenic.
They know how to pose.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So this is near Dallas. It's, you said, about an hour outside of Dallas, right? North
yes,
of Dallas.
An hour north of the airport.
Which is horse country up there. So
absolutely.
Yeah. Well, you can find more about that at Soltis. That's S-O-L, Solstice. It's hard to say. You can find that at solstice.com, and we'll put, for Training Center, we'll put the link to that in our show notes as well. At the so it's solstice.com is where you can find all the information about that. And they have a very nice website, so you can check it out there. Well, we are ready. Your first guest is ready.
To introduce Stephanie Ostrowski. She is a NATRC horse vet or veterinary judge. She's been a veterinarian since 1980, and she's board certified in preventative medicine, works 20 years at the CDC, and has been an NATRC competitor since 1991. And she's here to talk to us about heat exhaustion or heat prevention, heat stress prevention in the horse and rider.
Good morning, Dr. Ostrowski.
Good morning, and thank you for inviting me on your show.
Well, I'm
Hello?
So happy to have you. Hello.
Yes, you can hear me. Good.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm so happy to have you on the show today. First of all, I wanted to just have you tell us a little bit about your experience as a competitor and what you do for your horses to keep them competing in the hot weather. Since I know you live in Georgia and it's always hot and humid there in the summertime, I'm sure this is something that you run into often.
Yes, I've lived in the Southeast for probably about 25 years now, and moved about a year and a half ago even further south to Auburn, Alabama, where I'm teaching public health at the vet school there. Definitely, you have to modify your conditioning program. You have to really think about a lot of different things if you're living where it's very hot and humid. I don't know how many of your listeners have heard of something called a temperature humidity index or a heat stress index, but you could Google it online and print out a really nice chart with that's color-coded and tells you when you're getting into the danger zone. But a couple basic rules of thumb just to understand it is if you take the temperature, let's say it's going to be 90 degrees today, and you add it to the relative humidity where you happen to live, if it's 150 or higher, you need to start being cautious about heat stress. So in the South, we commonly have temperatures in the 90s and humidity in the 90s, and so we're up at about 180 to 190 on that temperature humidity index, which means that in the middle of summer we have extreme heat stress danger here. So one of the things we do is we learn to set our alarms early and get up and do our conditioning rides in the cool of the morning. It's kind of tough to set your alarm for 4:30 on the weekend, but you can get several good hours of riding in if you get up and out while the dew is still on the grass and things are nice and cool. Because it's really important if you're going to be competing or doing any rides of any intensity or distance that you go out and you condition in the conditions that you may be competing in. That takes a lot of discipline, and I can't say that I can always live up to my advice to people. but it's worth doing. The other thing is that I say is you prepare the horse, you prepare yourself, and you learn to do a few things like if you know that it's hotter and more humid than usual, something I haven't seen many people do, but which I try to remind myself to do, is don't just let the horse do all the work by sweating. Before you get on and ride out, you can take a hose and wet their neck and their front legs, and that will allow them to stay cool for probably, 15 to 20 minutes in the ride before they have to start sweating to cool themselves. That's important. If you've got horses with really luxurious manes and tails, braid those so that they don't trap heat. There's a product called the Dixie Midnight Saddle Pad that you can put on under your regular saddle pad, and it ventilates all along your horse's back and allows them to cool and not trap heat under that saddle. Ride in the shade if you can find shade to ride in. Stop if there's a stream or a puddle, and sponge your horse to add a little more water to them so they don't have to sweat it out. Anytime you're in competition and have to stop at a PNR, a pulse and respiration check, get out their sponge, use whatever water's available to cool them. Try to stand in the shade and in a breeze, and position them just slightly uphill to take the weight off of their weight off that diaphragm. Let them really fill their lungs as deeply as possible. Let me pause.
When you're wetting the horses down, is it important to also scrape the water back off? What happens to the water that sits on the horse's skin?
The water that sits on the horse's skin will evaporate. And if you're moving, your evaporative cooling is going to be excellent. So you don't want to stop riding to scrape the water off the horse's skin. When you're standing still, if there's no breeze, you may have experienced the fact that a horse can get hotter standing in an area where he's in the sun and there's no breeze, and they start panting harder. And when they had horses doing extreme exertion at the Summer Olympics in Atlanta, I think it was back in 96, one of the things they did was they would put cold water on the horses and scrape it off, but they also stood them in front of fans. And the point of that was to maximize their evaporative cooling.
That makes sense. How do you use electrolytes to help the horses manage the heat?
That's a very good question and a very important one. A lot of people don't have much experience. A lot of people who don't ride endurance or competitive trail don't have a lot of experience using electrolytes. One thing to do is always make sure your horse has a trace mineral salt block available to them in their stall or their pasture just every day. The other thing is Dr. Nancy Loving wrote a couple of great books, one for riders, and then she also wrote the veterinary manual for the performance horse. She's an endurance judge and as well as a competitor for many, many years. And she came up with the best rule of thumb I've ever heard of for the average person to understand. She said, you're going to need to replace 1 ounce of electrolytes for your horse for every 10 miles that you go, and that's if you never even see them sweat. If you see them sweat, they're going to need more than that. One of the things we found out is if you've got a competition coming up, and say you're going to do, or even just a trail ride, in the summer heat and humidity, and you say, well, we're going to go 20 miles on Saturday. Figure that's okay. 20 miles, that's 2 ounces. If they're going to sweat a lot because of the time of year and where you're riding, you might want to say, well, probably 3 to 4 ounces is going to be good. You can actually preload that about 72 hours in advance. Just put the powdered electrolytes in their grain mix, and it'll do you some good. They'll sort of have a little gas in the tank before they go out on that trail. And that way you don't have nearly as much to replace. And if you get into a situation where it's worse than you thought, you have a sense of comfort knowing that you've done what you could to prepare your horse that way. The other really important thing to do is if you're going to be, in the back country, especially where you can't just pick up the phone and have or run to your tack room and grab what you need, is ride with a tube of rapid acting electrolyte paste in your saddlebag. That is, there's some brands that are bioavailable within 5 minutes from the time you put it in your horse's mouth. It's in their bloodstream. And others that I haven't seen the specs on, but certainly anything that, any electrolytes, even if you just take the stuff you, the powdered electrolytes you have in the barn and feed it to your horse out there by hand. It's in their bloodstream and making everything balance back out within about 10 to 15 minutes.
Now, Dr. Ostrowski, there's people that argue about everything. I know on the endurance side, there's people that are saying, don't give electrolytes now, that's not the thing to do. How do you feel about that? Are you up to date on what their arguments are? I am not. I've just read that, and, we've discussed it here occasionally on the show.
Right. I haven't heard. I'm not sure what specific element of that, position you're referring to, because the endurance veterinary judges that I know of, they definitely recommend the use of electrolytes, recommend preloading and having the powdered form to feed to the horse to supplement and replenish what they've sweated out, both at the rest stops and when they get back into camp. They also, are fairly aggressive about supplementing on trail depending on the heat conditions. One of the things that sometimes is a problem is you have both buffered and non-buffered electrolytes, and the non-buffered one can be very irritating to the horse's GI tract, and horses, especially if they've had a tendency to ulcers, can be very uncomfortable from that. So it's important that there are buffered products out there, and those would be much better to use.
Okay, and does it say? Does it say on the label?
That it's buffered, yes, and they usually cost a little too.
Yeah, I know one of our big sponsors, Kentucky Performance Products, has Summer Games Plus, which I know is buffered. So, terrific. Sorry about that. All right.
Is there a bigger problem with if a horse is a heavier muscle horse? Is that are there any extra things you can do besides what we've already talked about for the bigger muscled horses?
It is definitely an issue.
Now, wait a minute. You're saying bigger muscled, or do you really mean fat? Are we talking fat or muscular?
Both.
The difference.
Actually.
Oh, okay. All right, good.
Fat is probably excess fat, like a horse that's got a crease down its back and, is in a heavy crest. They're going to have more just plain fat on them. And fat, as you know, insulates. So they're going to have a lot more trouble cooling than a horse that's relatively lean compared to that. But we also, in the Southeast, we see that heavily muscled horses, like the really stout-bodied quarter horses, and certainly draft horses or draft mixes, are going to have a lot of trouble cooling and maintaining comfortable body temperature, and not having to pant hard if they're competing. So part of that then is a really important thing to think of, is if you're going to ride those horses in the heat and the humidity, be sensible, be smart about the pace. Don't expect them to go fast and intensely, because they're not going to be able to cool off as well as a little whippet of an Arabian or a racking horse that's really, worked down and lean and well-conditioned that way. Some of the breeds, like the quarter horses and the draft horses, just don't slim down that much. they God gave them all that extra muscle mass, and it's there no matter what.
That makes sense. So can you tell us some things that are good to do for the rider so that we don't fall out while we're riding for fun or in competition, because that's equally important.
Right. I can't speak to that as much, but certainly they you know, Gatorade is an important thing. It's been well, it was developed for the football team at the University of Florida, I think, and that will help us replenish what we sweat out too. Making sure that you keep cool enough yourself. It's possible to like put cooling gel packs under your helmet to help keep your head cool. Wear a bandana around your neck and you know, keep it wet. Even if it's hot enough, take that sponge when you come to the water and sponge down your, you know, just put water down your neck and over your shoulders. It's not a fashion statement, but it definitely will cool you off if you're worried about, if you or one of your people you're riding with is starting to get red-faced and really uncomfortable from the heat.
So have you ever experienced heat exhaustion yourself when you've been competing, or have you been pretty lucky that way?
Not heat exhaustion for myself, but certainly I've been pretty proactive about cooling myself off, and if it got too hot, at stops I would take off my helmet and let my head cool, get the breeze through my hair, keep a wet bandana around my neck, and not worry about getting splashed when we came through those ponds or streams, but taking a little of that for myself as well as for the horse. I have them who got pretty red faced, started to have trouble, thinking clearly, and we pulled them aside, we got them over in the shade, fanned them. Gave them our wet bandanas and made sure that they were okay before we went on.
I had one more question about the horses. I was thinking about how at our pulse and respiration stop,
mm-hmm.
some people will pull their saddles and some people don't. And I wondered how big a difference that makes to the horse's cooling. I mean, cause I've heard people argue back and forth about, well, it upsets my horse too much to have to resettle everything versus pulling the saddle off to get the air really cooling around their horse's body. What's been your experience with that?
Well, I think that if you're worried, if your horse is doing sufficiently well, that you're more concerned about just having them unsettled from the tack coming off and being put back on, you're probably not the person whose horse really needs to have the saddle stripped. But if a horse comes into a pulse and respiration stop, panting and dripping sweat, you've got about 10 minutes to get them not panting and cool down to the point where you won't get hold time on them. And I definitely recommend that if your horse comes in panting and radiating heat, that you pull that saddle, get them into whatever shade's available. A lot of us carry folding fans, fan the horse, sponge the big veins inside all four legs and the jugular, along the jugular veins. If they'll let you sponge their face, that helps to cool too. But you can get pretty aggressive about that, and sometimes you need to.
Well, that sounds great. Thank you so much for coming on today. I really appreciate your knowledge and expertise in this timely topic for the middle of the summer.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure to join your program, and thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Yeah, I was thinking about some of those horses you were talking about probably shouldn't be out there in the first place in the middle of summer.
Well, that's sometimes true. One of my friends rides a three-quarter Percheron, and it's not so much that she's not fit. It's just that there's just so much of her that she can't cool herself off.
Yep. My little rescue pony that was so skinny is now getting to that point where he's going to be on the other side of things. He has to wear his muzzle a couple hours a day now, which is, by the way, highly insulting to a Hackney pony. Just let me know.
Yeah, our old pony, Joe Bear, did never have to wear a muzzle, but he suffered through the summer quite a bit the last few years. He just got to where he wouldn't shed his coat, and you know, the heat would just really get in. Winters were great, but the summers were rough.
That's right, yeah. And summers, especially with the older horses, they tend to be harder on them with respiration and breathing and things. And I know that you just lost a pony that was 40, and we had my old driving pony was almost 40, and we had another one that was 45. So ponies can go a long time. They're tough little creatures.
Can.
Yeah.
Really,
and, you know, the more ornery the pony, the longer they live.
Oh, well, our pony was very ornery.
Lived to 40, see?
That's right.
And, you know, the more annoying the dog, the longer they live. And cats are that way, too. I think that's a rule. I think it's a general rule. Your nice, sweet puppy that never causes any trouble, or your nice, sweet cat that never causes any trouble, they die at 12. The others live to 25. So,
that's
yeah. Yeah. Just to torture us. That's what happens. Well, we're going to take a break. We have a little Jared Rogerson coming up with Same Dark Trail. We'll be right back. After we hear from Jared, we have another guest coming up to continue our conversation really about health in the horse this morning.
Deep in the darkest canyon, with ghosts at every turn, I'd crossed 1,000 raging rivers and swore I'd never learn the answer to a question I didn't even know. Down the same dark trail you were traveling alone, 2,000 miles away from home, into the western sunset you did roam, a hard way to go. Down the same dark trail we were lost and found each other. The feeling is so bright, but the lightning and the thunder as they are, confusion clouds a vision of our hearts, we fall apart. Down the same dark trail we were lost and found each other and our sisters and our brothers. Don't know the pain that we try to hide, so we just cry for our lives. Down the same dark trail, you can still do something right. Even in the fiery midst of hell, you don't have to fail. On the same dark trail, down the same dark trail, we found we have to let them go.
That Same Dark Trail by Jared Rogerson. You can find all of his music at jaredrogerson.com. You're listening to Horses in the Morning. I am Glenda Geek, and I am here with Alice from the North American Trail Ride Conference. And, of course, we are doing the once-a-month special trail riding episode, concentrating a little bit on the horse's health today, because that's something that trail riders must be concerned with, especially when you're going out for like Alice does, when you're going out for 4, 5, 6 hours. You want to know that your horse is in good shape, and you are as well. And, of course, we have Coach Jen over in the producer chair. And tomorrow morning on Horses in the Morning, we have our really bad ad section where our listeners submit really bad Craigslist ads for horses for sale and things like that. And we just make a little fun of them. And for that, we give a prize to the best ones. Jennifer, what is our prize this week? Let's see if we got
our prizes this week
here.
Are provided by the good folks at Redmond Equine, who make the Redmond salt that we are talking about all the time here on the show. It's the salt brick that we use for our horses here at Horse Radio Network headquarters. It's all natural salt put there by Mother Nature, dug out of the ground, tossed to your local tack shop, and then your horse gets to eat it. It has all of the naturally occurring elements that Mother Nature intended. And the other prize is provided by Horse Grooming Solutions. When you need effective and economical grooming products for your horse, you need to go to the Horse Grooming Solutions brands that you have come to know and love, like Healthy Hair Care, voted number one horse health care brand by consumers, Silverado Equine, and Old Timers Equine. That's Glenn's favorite. You can visit them online at horsegroomingsolutions.com, or you can find all of those brands at your local tack and feed supplier.
It's all what you can relate to. So get your ads in to Jennifer at horseradionetwork.com. Put really bad ads in the subject line. Copy and paste the entire ad into the email. Do not just send the link, because it'll be dead by the time Jennifer gets to it. And you can hear your ad on the show tomorrow morning here at 9 a.m. Eastern. Alice, do you use Redmond Rocks at all? Have you tried them?
I haven't, but it sounds really awesome.
Oh, you need to. They're at any of your local tack shops, and they may seem a little bit more expensive than the white, you know, processed bricks that you get, because these are rocks. They just cut the rocks out of the quarry and dump them in, and you just get the whole rock. They're not processed in any way, shape, or form. And they even make ones now. They make the Redmond Rock on a rope, where they drill a hole in the middle of it, put a rope through it, and you can tie it on your fence or in the stall. And that's what we do with our horses. And Scooter just loves his Redmond Rocks. He tries to chew it like candy. He just is all the time using his teeth on it to try and chew it. He'll sit there and lick that thing for 20 minutes. It's just incredible. And he doesn't touch other salt, like the white salt bricks and stuff he wouldn't touch, but the Redmond Rocks he absolutely loves. Highly recommend them. They're really good stuff.
Awesome.
Especially, you could carry them with you on the trail, too, which is kind of nice.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we like to have salt at the trailer when we're competing. I can honestly say I use a lot of loose salt, and my horse typically just flips it over. But this would be better, so he wouldn't spill it on the ground.
Well, yeah, and, you know, that is one nice thing about the rope one, is you can do that. I mean, you just hang it on the fence or hang it on the side of the trailer, wherever your horse is tied, and you're good to go. Yeah, really good stuff. I really like that. All right, good. Well, we're ready with your next guest.
All right, our next guest is Melissa Neal from Cold River Equine, Arts Medicine and Rehabilitation Center. She has been a horsewoman for over 30 years. And started her business in Burney, Texas. She realized the need for post-operative care and conditioning of equine athletes and is now located in Crescent, Texas. And she's here to tell us about what she does at her facility, including her rehabilitation and lessons. So, Melissa, it's great to hear from you today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, first of all, tell us a little bit about your facility. I have gotten to use your Aqua Tread several times with my horses, and I just think your whole setup is really cool. So tell us a little bit about your facility.
Oh, thank you. We are located in the triangle between Weatherford, Fort Worth, and Granbury, so it's very convenient for traveling. We are housed on 15 acres. We have 30 stalls. An Aqua Tread, which is an underwater treadmill, the Equicizer, which is a tie-free hot walker. And then we also have therapy units such as pulse electromagnetics, E-stem, laser, and ultrasound.
So what are some of the benefits to horses using your facilities for conditioning? What are you able to do for them that people wouldn't be able to accomplish on their own, especially in the summertime?
Well, of course, you know, in the summer in Texas, we have to deal with the heat. And a lot of people are heat intolerant, and horses as well. You have to worry about over-conditioning and then developing anhidrosis, which is the inability to sweat, which is kind of stems from small heat strokes from what I've been told by veterinarians. So the wonderful benefit of the AquaTread is it's an opportunity for them to cool their core temperature for 15 to 20 minutes in the water. There's also the benefit that you can't get from riding, which is muscle mass. The resistance of the water from the horses pushing forward against that, it develops the forearms and the chest and the hindquarters and the gaskins much more than just long trotting and loping in the arena.
Now, my driving pony loves water. I think he would jump in this thing and just have a blast. Now, is it hard to get some horses in it?
Well, you bet. Of course. It's so foreign. If this was sitting out in the pasture, would they walk in it? No way.
No, no. Well, so, mine might, actually. He loves water, so he might.
Yeah. Some are part Labradors, and they love to just jump right in. But it takes patience. It takes skill, and it takes repetition. So what we do to get the horses in, first and foremost, I like to always say that we do not sedate horses to get them into the AquaTread. We take
well,
that,
yeah,
time.
That's probably a good idea. You don't really want her head sagging while they're in the AquaTread.
Well, it wouldn't be that much tranquilizer, but I just don't believe in it. You know, every horse goes at their own cognitive ability, and if it takes me 30 minutes to get them in the pool to work them out for 10, so be it. Because tomorrow it'll only take me 10 and then 5, and then they walk in like a seasoned pro. But it's based on positive reinforcement. We ask for one step forward at a time. Stop, praise, let their heart rate come down, let them deal with what we're asking them to do, and then we go forward again.
So it's similar to getting them in the trailer. I mean, ones that have trouble trailering, it's the same thing. I mean, it's the same thing as really training them to do anything. Now, are there some that just never like it, or do all of them seem to adapt and then, you know, after 4 or 5 times just hop in?
Well, in the 8 years that I've been using the AquaTread, I cannot think of one horse who just does not think it's the bomb once they figure it out. They love it.
Yeah, it's got to be. It's like us swimming, right? I mean, same thing.
Yeah.
Now, is it expensive? Because, you know, I'm asking all these questions because 99% of us have never done this with our horses and probably would have never considered doing it. So that's why I'm asking these questions, because it's something that you would say not just for rehabilitation, but also in general would be a good workout for your horse, right?
Yes, it is. And it, you know, it breaks the monotony of what you do with your horse. You run out of different ways to exercise and condition. And by putting them in the pool, it's mentally invigorating. They get their caloric burn. And then they can go back and take a power nap for the rest of the day. But no, it's extremely affordable. To put your horse in the pool just one time is $25. And
really?
For the work we really?
Now, I was picturing, to be honest with you, I had no idea, and I was picturing $100.
Woohoo! Hey, I'll for $100. No, it's very affordable. It's $25, and then when you buy packages of 5, 10, 15 swims, we cut you a little discount in there, too, when you buy in bulk. And we also have packages that have boarding. If you don't want a trailer back and forth, you live too far away or you're out of state, we can house them as well.
Huh. Interesting. So, and then you regulate – sorry, Alice, I'm hijacking you here.
Sorry,
you regulate – I just want to understand how this works because we've never talked about it here on the show before. So it is a treadmill type of situation. Is that right? Or is there a stream going at them? How does that work? How does that actually work?
How does it work? Underneath the water is a complex machine and that is that is a maintenance mongrel. So if you were thinking of putting one in, you're better off just to trailer over to me. It's a treadmill that we can vary the speed on, which is the beauty of it, of aqua treading versus swimming. The aqua tread, if you have a horse that's fresh out of surgery, they're not really allowed to do a lot of motion. Say your vet has prescribed hand walking for 5 minutes. Well, to put them in the aqua tread for that amount of time is so much more beneficial. We can slow that treadmill down to a snail's pace, and the horse is still traveling level, which is important to their physical development. Yes. So then the horse starts getting a little bit more strong. You can move it up to a power walk. Then once you get the vets okay and things are looking good, you can push them up to a trot for conditioning. So when the horse goes home, you don't have this jello-y, muscle-poor, and totally anxious horse coming home. They've been exercised within restrictions, and their muscle mass is actually better than when they got hurt.
Okay. Makes sense.
So I know you said that you have, you know, opportunities for people to board the horses there if they can't trailer back and forth. But, like, I know you also have your other exerciser. What kind of a program, like, tell some of the things that you put together to make a conditioning program for people who maybe if they're going on vacation for a week or if they just need to let the horses up for a couple weeks.
Oh, absolutely. A perfect example, a gal just dropped her horse off that's going to go ride up in the mountains in New Mexico. So our program for her horse is I have 3 weeks total. The first week is going to be nothing but the pool to get the horse going, get some cardio in it and put on some muscle mass, but not fatigue the horse too quickly. You have to be careful if they're really overweight or out of shape. Then the next week, we alternate between the equisizer, which is a tie-free hot walker, and the pool. The equisizer, you can go any program that you want. So you can just walk for 10 minutes, you can slow trot, you can extend a trot, and you can lope. My equisizer is large enough that if the horse goes on the outside wall and they don't cheat, then they can take in a full lope all the way around the 60-foot round pen. So
now, the equisizer, you said that's the one that doesn't tie them by the head. That's the one that sort of pushes them with the gait, you know, the gait.
Yes, correct.
Yeah,
if they go too fast, they run into a wall. If too slow, it bumps them in the hindquarters. So then the last week that the horse is here, we will actually double up. We'll put them in the equisizer in the morning and the pool in the afternoon. So when you get your horse back, he's Hans and Franz and ready to tackle the mountains.
So, and besides the rehab, you also offer lessons, and you've done some really interesting and unique obstacle training. Can you tell us about those?
Oh yes, you get diversified the longer you're in the horse industry, and somehow along the way I found the niche of desensitization clinics. This was my 11th year and my 48th class. And the clinics, you know, they're high intensity. You're dealing with animals that are fearful and frightful of anything foreign. And we take that and change it into instead of being frightened of it, let's come over here and think about it together. Flip your brain from right brain to left. So the obstacles that I have out on the course, we have the full day of the desensitization clinic, but I also do obstacle training for competitive trail. So if you're having a sticky spot or you just need to round your horse out for desensitizing and getting them to master obstacles in the way that the judges like to score you highly, then I work with individuals on that as well.
So, one of the other things that I've always found really interesting about your business is that you recommend the use of chiropractic and acupuncture and herbs and things. Like, you've helped several people with their horses that had anhidrosis. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. You know, it's not one thing that is going to heal your horse. It's not one modality that's going to get you where you need to be. You can max out what Western medicine or Eastern medicine has to offer, but when you combine the two, you get a whole horse in the end. Acupuncture has been one of my leading benefits of finding that one thing that's just quite not right with your horse. They're off. You can't put your finger on it. Dr. Moss is wonderful about going into the, she like peels an onion down and she gets to the core of the problem. Is it a spleen, a liver? Is it just the neural pathways that aren't connected? A lot of this goes way over my head, which is why I hire it out. But the results I see are absolutely amazing. Chiropractics, that's for, you know, your basic core horse needs to have a square structure. If their pelvis is tilted, if their shoulder's jammed, if their neck is out, that horse is never going to function right. He's going to misfire at the barrel. He's not going to push off going up and down hills. When you go to work that cow and he has to cut back and he falls back on those hindquarters, if he's not right, he's going to start falling apart. Chiropractics should be a basic fundamental thing that everyone does to their horse at least 2 times a year. And that's pending nothing is wrong. That's just a good care regime. And then in conjunction with that, you get into the herbs. I try, you know, and stay away from the drugs that we prescribe. Now, of course, if you're a veterinarian, if they are in need of them, of course, absolutely. But then it has its side effects. And if you can find something that has a more natural origin without all the chemicals in it and still get the same result, it's best to transition to that once you get past the medical side of what they're needing the drugs for.
Well, I know that, yeah, and Dr. Wendy Ying is a co-host of our driving radio show, and she does a traditional Chinese medicine segment every week with us on the driving radio show. And I got to tell you, I didn't know what to think about herbs and about acupuncture, and she does laser as well and all of those kind of things. But after hearing her talk about the traditional Chinese medicine and some of the things that they've been doing for thousands of years and now are really coming to the forefront, and mainstream either veterinarians or people doctors are starting to realize that they need to pay attention to this. And the problem is most veterinarians don't get any herbal training or any nutrition training of any degree at all in vet school or doctor school for that matter. So they're just coming to this on their own and starting to research it more. Chiropractors are starting to become involved more with the acupuncturists and things like that. So it really is an area that is growing like crazy right now. Have you seen the same thing? People are more accepting of it than they used to be 5 years ago.
Very much so. And it is thanks to our veterinarians that are opening their eyes and opening their minds to alternative therapies that aren't just taught in the Western doctorate field. It's about expanding yourself to encompass what the whole world has to offer. We get stuck in a rut in the United States, and we don't venture out and go into what is what they call traditional Chinese medicine over there. You bring some of our medications over there, and it's foreign, and they shut their door to it as well. So it's about the community of medicine that we can benefit all of our animals if we just unite on that field.
Yeah, and, you know, they're taught that. I mean, to their defense, they're taught that, you know, if there's something wrong, you have a pill, you have a surgery, you have something that physically you can do that way. And that's what they're taught in medical school. They're not really taught the alternatives. So the ones that, like you said, the ones that are really coming around to it have done it on their own after medical school. That's when they really pursued it and got some additional education about it.
Yes, absolutely.
And don't be afraid, and I think, Melissa, you probably back me up on this, don't be afraid to ask your vet, you know, how do they feel about these things. And if you want a vet that is a little bit more open-minded, you're going to have to ask. I mean, you're going to have to, and don't be afraid to ask those questions. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes, I agree. And there are certain vets out there that advertise themselves as alternative therapy doctors. So, you know, you have to be careful when you talk to your vet about alternative therapies, because some don't want to have anything to do with it, and they're going to try and persuade you away from it. And then you have others that embrace it. So you have to research what type, what style of doctor that you're looking for, and then narrow your search down to those.
Right, exactly. Alice?
I was going to ask Melissa, because we know each other from doing our competitive trail ride stuff, but I wanted her to talk a little bit about something new that she's taken on lately that I just have enjoyed watching her do on Facebook, which is the cowboy mounted shooting. I think you've just kind of started that in the last year or so, but you've been really successful with it. And I was just wanted you to talk about it a little bit.
Oh, my gosh, guys. This is the bomb. I'm having so much fun. You know, as we ride our horses through the years, you get into a sport and you kind of max it out and you move on to something else. And it's just one thing after another. I've done dressage and reining and barrels and competitive trail. And I've done all kinds of stuff. But I don't know. I had this hunch and talking with my friend and said, hey, you know, what do you think about this shooting stuff? You want to try it? Well, next thing you know, I'm out here like Annie Oakley going bananas, shooting, blowing up balloons and hitting targets, and it is so much fun. The cool thing about cowboy-mounted shooting is the horsemanship that is involved in it. It's about perfecting your patterns and not letting your horse drop his shoulder in a turn. It's the rollbacks, the slide stops. There are 70 different patterns. So for people like me who like to multitask, I don't know what I'm faced with until I get there, and I love the element of surprise with that. And it's just you and your horse, your gun, and the clock. And there are no get-out-of-jail-free cards. How you get in there and shoot and run is just a direct reflection of your teamwork with your animal and how accurate you can be. But the people that do it are what has me hooked. They are so nice and friendly and open. Yeah, you're competing against everybody, but it's still a big brotherhood and sisterhood when you go. And for me, being a lower-level shooter, I see some patterns that I've never seen before, and I can walk up to a world champion and say, I'm lost. Can you help me? And they're like, absolutely. And they think nothing of it. They're so warm and friendly.
I got to tell you, it's so funny because everybody that we've had on the show over the years that has gotten into mounted shooting, you've perked up when she asked that question, and your light went on, and you became so bright and animated, and that happens every time we ask somebody who's just gotten into mounted shooting. Tammy Sarantz is the world champion mounted shooter and is a co-host on this show once a month, and we've been talking to her for years, and it's just so much fun to watch it, and everybody has that reaction that gets into it.
I know. She's my instructor.
Is she, Tammy?
Yes, I am a product of her education.
Well, that's great. You're being instructed by the best in the world, so good for you.
I am.
Does she have you wearing a helmet yet?
No, I haven't got there yet. I'm still a baseball cap kind of gal.
Okay, all right. She'll have you wearing a helmet in no time. That'll happen.
Probably so.
I've told this story before, but first time I actually met Tammy in person was years ago at the World Equestrian Games, and we had her on the show a number of times and had been talking to her a number of times, and I met her, and she had her horse trailer with her and her sleeping quarters horse trailer, and she said, come in here, and she started pulling guns out from everywhere. There was a gun in the refrigerator. I mean, there were guns underneath the mattress. There was a gun in the shower. And she said, here's all my guns. And she was just the same way. She's won, 1,000 belt buckles. Her wall's just covered in belt buckles.
Oh, yeah.
And yet she's still as excited about it as she was day one. I mean, it's just so cute.
I know.
I don't know what that sport is. Shooting guns apparently does something to people.
It kind of brings out the beast in us all. I don't know.
Yes, you Texas girls, look out.
See, the only experience I have with guns is we have a fun activity that we do. We did last summer, and we did mounted water pistol shooting on some pipelets. And that's my only claim to fame with
that
guns.
That is awesome.
The super soaker.
I love it.
It was great fun. You know, you had to, like, run down and scream. And I don't know how they do it because, like, I kept trying to shoot with my right hand even when the target was on my left, and that didn't work out so well.
Melissa, there's a growing movement now, too, in mounted cart shooting, so actually doing it from a cart. Doing the same thing, basically doing the same pattern, only you really need to learn to drive with one hand. That is one thing. But, that's becoming a thing now, too. So I think anything involving guns and Texas, you're going to have to put those two together. Congratulations
right.
for getting into that. I think you're going to look at you. In 5 years, you're going to have all those belt buckles on your wall, too.
Oh, slow down a little. I just graduated to level 2, so. But yeah, it's what I do to keep, you know, to keep myself involved in the horse industry. And while I'm out there shooting, I do talk about, you know, Coal River Equine and the benefits of the water and, you know, what we're doing with these horses, with these fast, quick turns and the rollbacks and the stage after stage and sitting on their back for hours at a time. It's really nice to stick them in that pool and watch them get revitalized so that they can face another shoot. So, and we also sponsor prizes and packages at the shoot. So, you know, if you wanted to get into the shooting, you just may take home a package of AquaTread swims. So,
Well, that's terrific. You know, I definitely am going to be looking into the AquaTread here in Ocala. I'm sure we have them in Florida here. And maybe take my pony for a swim. I just think that would be so cool to see him do it. And now that I know it's affordable, which I didn't realize before, that's definitely something I'm going to take a look at.
Yeah, it's very affordable.
What's your
website?
What is your website? Where can people find you?
Oh, you can find me easily at coldriverequine.com. And that's COLD, in case I have a southern accent, it sounds like coal.
COLD, riverequine.com, and you'll find her website there. I'm on it now, so all the information is there, how to contact them, and goes through the different kinds of therapies and training, and you can find it all there at Cold River Equine. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Melissa.
Well, thank you for having me. You're welcome.
All right. Good luck with the mounted shooting.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Jennifer, did you pick up on that too? It happens every single time we have somebody. It's the discipline that people get most excited about when they first get into it.
Ah.
Well, they're shooting guns.
It's true.
Well, it's something that we've wanted to try. We have several friends that do it. And my husband went out to shoot one of the events with his camera one day, and he got some really cool pictures. And everybody just looks like they're having so much fun.
I mean, we had Uncle Jimmy from Uncle Jimmy's products, and we had Uncle Jimmy on, and he was he was a cattle sorter, and did all kinds of those kind
cattle
of cattle
cutting,
ranch sorting, He did all those kind of cattle things, and then he got into mounted shooting, and we had him on the show, and he had been doing sorting and stuff for 20 years, and we had him on the show, and he's like a little kid. He was just.
I have an idea, Alice.
Yep.
I'm going to put this in. I'm officially putting this in the NATRC suggestion box.
Okay.
You can create a new obstacle for NATRC events. It's the shoot the target one, and you have to come up. And you don't have to carry your own squirt gun because not everybody might have one. But you have to take a squirt gun that is at the obstacle, and you have to shoot a target. Because, you know, if you were out on the backwoods trail, you would probably take a pistol with you because you're back in the backcountry where there's bears. Or you might have to carry with you bear spray, which is getting more and more common. You carry bear spray when you work in the backcountry. So you have to be able to take it out of your saddlebag and shoot it at a target. Wouldn't that be an
awesome?
There you go. I like
it. Great. They're worried about kids going out with knives. Now you're having them carry guns.
No, super soaker.
You
need
a water gun.
They're filled with blanks anyway, so, right?
No, super soaker. You got to use a super soaker. I like
that. Oh, there you go.
Family friendly.
Well, we did on one of our Texas Trail Challenge, we always have a timed event, and we did that water pistol shooting the paper plates thing at one of those rides
as
well. And it's a lot of fun because, like, they have somebody listening to make sure you hit all the plates with the water because they're plastic plates.
Yeah.
So you can hear it. It's,
there you go.
Oh, and that adds an added degree of difficulty because it's going to make a noise when it hits the plate.
Exactly. A lot of horses will shy away from that.
Yeah, so at the beginner level, you give them a paper plate that doesn't make any noise, and at the more advanced level, you give them the plastic plate. I like it.
There you go.
Well, we're running out of time here. What about the ride calendar? What's coming up?
Well, what's coming up in the next month? The ride season is in full swing if you're in cold weather country. There are two rides in Colorado before our next show. One is in Willow Springs in Jefferson, Colorado, this weekend, July 19th and 20th. And there's also a ride called Island in the Sky on the Grand Mesa, August 2nd and 3rd. And there's also a ride this weekend in Alaska. Alaska puts on two rides every year, and this is one of the two rides.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and I got to go to the Island in the Sky ride 2 years ago. They do it every other year, and it's gorgeous. I didn't get to do the whole trail because I got lost. Colorado. It wasn't entirely my fault. A guy from Colorado led us astray, and we believed him.
Gotta watch this Colorado. Gotta watch.
Yeah.
But it was gorgeous. Even the part that I rode that was wrong was really pretty. So.
Yeah, I mean, where are you going to go wrong up there, right? So.
Exactly.
Well, we have quite a few Alaska listeners, so hello to everybody up there.
Yep, the Alaska ride is in Wasilla. I hope I'm saying
that. Oh, good, yeah.
So it's called the Bald Mountain Butt Buster.
Lynn, are you telling me that you knew where that town was? Really?
Yeah, Wasilla, Lisa Marie Kelly from Ice Road Truckers has talked about Wasilla. So I'll have to let her know this ride.
Random crap, Glenn.
Well, I talk to a lot of people. You know, we have a lot of guests here on the shows. Yeah,
okay.
I do know the most random crap. Yep, but I'll definitely have to let her know that that's going on. Maybe she'll take a ride over.
There you go.
Check it out. Well, thank you very much. Where can people find the ride calendar and all the other information about the North American Trail Ride Conference?
They can go to www.natrc.org.
And, of course, Alice is with us every month. It's the third Thursday of the month. She joins us. If you missed the past episodes, you can go to horsesinthemorning.com, and you can scroll down through all of the different episodes there and find them. We've had over 960 episodes of Horses in the Morning, and if you want to get caught up, you can find them all there. You can go back to episode number one if you'd like. We don't recommend it because we were pretty bad back then, but we've gotten better over the years. And as I said, Alice, you also you can find all the information about the North American Trail Ride Conference on Facebook as well, because you guys have a Facebook page. Just search for that. You'll find it over there. And our show, Horses in the Morning, on Facebook as well. And one other thing is the best way to listen to our shows, the easiest, simplest way, is either iTunes. A lot of people listen through iTunes, or you can download our app at the Horse Radio Network. Go to the iOS or Android App Store, search for Horse Radio Network, download the app. It's free, it's easy, and it is the simplest way and most reliable way to listen to the shows. Thank you, Alice. We'll talk to you again next month, and have a terrific weekend camping this weekend.
I hope so. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care. Be safe.
All right.
Yeah, start at episode 948 or so to get to this one. I think it took about that long to get there.